badly. We needed it to shift our stuck polling numbers. We tried everything to goad or cajole Trump into it. He'd agreed, and then his team, who was more disciplined than he was, would pull him back. So that meant Tim would have to be the closer. It was not a comfortable role for him. He had fretted from the outset that he wasn't a good debater. I'd discounted his concerns. He was so quick and pithy in front of the crowds at our rallies, I thought he'd bring those qualities to the podium. He'd prepared with Pete Buttigieg, a consummate debater, and I thought his big heart and his good humor would counter J.D. Vance's malice and pessimism. But J.D. Vance is a shapeshifter and a shifty guy. He understood that his default meanness wouldn't play against Tim Walz's sunny disposition and patent decency. Throughout the debate, he toned the anger and the insults way down. As Van Jones later remarked, he sane-washed the crazy. There were no cat ladies, no pet-eating Haitians, no personal insults. Just a mild-mannered, aw-shucks appellation, pretending he had a lot of common ground with that nice Midwestern coach. When Tim fell for it and started nodding and smiling at J.D.'s fake bipartisanship, I moaned to Doug, "What is happening?" I told the television screen, "You're not there to make friends with the guy who is attacking your running mate." There was not supposed to be any on-air fact-checking in this debate, as there had been in mine. But the moderators did correct Vance twice on the overwhelming scientific consensus on climate change and on the legal immigration status of Haitians in Springfield. "The rules were you guys weren't going to fact-check," Vance complained petulantly in a flash of his more familiar persona. Tim fell into a pattern of defending his record as a governor. Then he fumbled his answer when the moderator predictably questioned why he had claimed to be in Hong Kong during the democracy protest in Tiananmen Square. Tim had been on his way to teach in China that summer, but hadn't yet left the United States on the date of the massacre. Instead of simply stating that he'd gotten his dates mixed up, but that being in China during a period of human rights oppression had profoundly influenced him, he talked about biking in Nebraska. The following weekend, Saturday Night Live did a sketch in which actors posed as Doug and me, sitting on our couch watching the debate. While I did not, in fact, spit out wine, it was otherwise uncanny in its portrait of our evening. Tim felt bad that he hadn't done better. I reassured him that the election would not be won or lost on account of that debate. And in fact, it had a negligible effect on our polling. In choosing Tim, I thought that as a second-term governor and 12-year congressman, he would know what he was getting into. In hindsight, how could anyone? When they attacked his National Guard record, I had to talk to him about being resilient. It's a challenge when you have kids. Tim had a son still in high school and a young adult daughter whom I'd come to know to be as big-hearted as her dad. It's painful for them to hear their father unfairly attacked. For the candidate, the family that is your source of strength can become your weakness in a presidential campaign. Tim was outraged by the unfairness. How dare they? This is BS. I had to tell him, don't let them get in your head. When I was a newly elected DA, an elderly gentleman in Atlanta pulled me aside with a bit of advice. "Baby, you be sure and don't make it look too easy." He knew it was not. And the higher you rise in the political food chain, the harder it gets. This is not a genteel profession. You must be ready to brawl. October 2nd, 34 days to the election. In Augusta, Georgia, the neighborhood of Meadowbrook, downed power lines looped over fallen trees. The once tidy streets of low-slung ranch houses were strewn with debris. A young woman wept as she recounted how her husband had been killed in the storm. She left her bedroom because her daughter needed something, and in the moment that she was gone, a tree fell on that room where her husband lay in bed. As I made my way through the wreckage of homes and lives, the first responders described their tireless efforts to bring help. I was able to announce that the federal government would be reimbursing 100% of the cost of the recovery effort to local governments for the next 3 months, which doesn't always happen. I said that there was an immediate emergency grant of $750 available to anyone just by providing their address. This got wildly misconstrued. Misinformation spread that $750 was all the victims would receive, which was ridiculous, but caused much unnecessary pain and anger. Anger that Trump was glad to fan. At the local senior center, I helped volunteers hand out meals to weary men and women facing the long labor of rebuilding their lives. It was, as always, such a stark contrast of the way disaster calls forth the best and worst of human nature. October 3rd, 33 days to the election. Country over party, read the signs at the entrance to Ripon College. The Republican Party was founded before the Civil War in Ripon, Wisconsin, in 1854 with the aim of stopping the spread of slavery. Liz Cheney had come here today to help me stop Trump. She had been the third highest-ranking Republican in House leadership until her outspoken opposition to Trump, and her revulsion at his role on January 6th cost her leadership positions and then her seat in Congress. There are many things Liz Cheney and I don't agree on, but we agree on many fundamental principles. High on that list, free and fair elections, the rule of law, and the First Amendment. And you can have respect for someone with whom you disagree. There had been a debate in the campaign about where to put our time and resources. Should we focus on turning out our base, or should we give equal priority to talking to our opponent's base? At a strategy meeting in early August, Jen O'Malley Dillon advised that we really needed to bring Trump's numbers down, since the universe of undecided voters had contracted. The time for persuasion, she said, was earlier in the cycle and had passed. People were going home to their base. Time is the most valuable commodity in any campaign, especially in one as brief as ours. I was glad to give some time to campaigning with Liz Cheney in the hope that we could reach those Republicans who believe, as we do, that fundamental principles of our democracy should never be partisan issues. The amount of that time, however, was exaggerated by the media's interest in our unlikely pairing. We campaigned together for only 1.5 days. She started her speech that day in Ripon by proclaiming that she had been a Republican, quote, even before Donald Trump started spray tanning. She was frank about her conservative values, limited government, low taxes, strong defense, and that family, not government, is the most important structure in society. Fidelity to the Constitution, she said, is, quote, the most conservative of our conservative values. She urged the audience, quote, to reject the depraved cruelty of Donald Trump. She said she had never voted for a Democrat, but that she would proudly vote for me. Quote, I know that she will be a president who will defend the rule of law, and I know she will be a president who can inspire all of our children, and if I might say so, especially our little girls, to do great things, she said. So help us right the ship of our democracy so that history will say of us, when our time of testing came, we did our duty and we prevailed because we loved our country more. After the election, I invited her to come to the vice president's residence with her 5 children. I imagined her kids had the same fond feelings about the house where their grandfather lived for 8 years as ours do. Our security footprint was too big to go visiting, so family came to us. And the residence was the one place big enough for all of us to be together, casual and private. So casual that my baby nieces did not always appreciate that the art we had on loan from the Smithsonian was extremely valuable. On a podium on the first floor, I had a large and gorgeous vase made by an acclaimed American artist. One day, to my complete dismay, I discovered Amara and Leela at the top of the stairs, bending over the banister, trying to see who could land a ball of socks in the vase the most times. I imagine Liz Cheney's kids have memories of similar antics. October 5th, 31 days to the election. In the hills and valleys of western North Carolina, the force of the floodwaters buckled roads, picked up tractor trailers, uprooted trees, and washed away homes. 86 people in the state had been killed. The damage was even worse than what I'd witnessed in Georgia. Usually, hurricane effects are most severe on the coast, but unexpectedly, inland mountain communities had been hardest hit. Before the storm, the area had experienced several days of heavy rain, saturating the soil and filling rivers. The Blue Ridge Mountains acted as a funnel, channeling the hurricane's massive rainfall through the valleys. The North Carolina Air National Guard had been flying supplies into remote mountain communities and doing low-altitude sweeps of the hills and hollows, looking for people in need of rescue since roads and bridges had been washed away and communications were down. As I shook hands and looked into tired young faces, I realized that some of them had also suffered loss in the storm, but were still showing up, helping others. I told them, "You are doing God's work on the ground." October 7th, 29 days to the election. I taped my interview with 60 Minutes on the anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel. Bill Whitaker's first several questions probed the state of Middle Eastern security and our relationship with Netanyahu, who had resisted our calls for a ceasefire and had gone into Lebanon despite U.S. advice. He wanted to know if in pursuing our goal of ending the war, we had a reliable ally in Netanyahu. I answered that the question should be about the alliance between the American people and the Israeli people, which I maintained was strong. He pivoted then to the U.S. economy and other subjects. It was a long interview, and it was, of course, edited down, as is usual. When a bit of the edited footage was used as a promo on Face the Nation, Trump sued CBS for $20 billion, baselessly claiming that 60 Minutes edited the interview to make me look good. It was a nonsense claim, a frivolous suit, and in normal times, CBS management would have brushed it off. But CBS is owned by Paramount Global, which was in the midst of seeking a merger with Skydance Media and needed approval from the Federal Communications Commission. Paramount's controlling shareholder, Sherry Redstone, stood to make hundreds of millions if the deal went through. Paramount ultimately settled the suit for $16 million, in a move that veteran correspondent Dan Rather termed, quote, a sellout to extortion by the president. Bill Owens, the respected executive producer of 60 Minutes, and Wendy McMahon, the chief of CBS News, both had earlier resigned from their jobs because of corporate pressure to shape the news to Trump's sensibilities. The Fourth Estate is so called because it is a key pillar of democracy. When corporations take it over and put profit ahead of accurate, brave, and truthful reporting, the whole edifice trembles. October 8th, 28 days to the election. Everything about my appearance on The View was going well, until it wasn't. I'd been on this show about 5 times before. Some of the hosts I knew from outside the studio. Whoopi Goldberg and I bonded over our shared ties to the Bay Area. Sunny Hostin I knew as a lawyer. She had been a prosecutor, like me. Anna Navarro, a Republican, I debated on immigration during the Bush years, but we aligned on many other issues. All the hosts are thoughtful women of different political stripes, but all had been outspoken about the dangers presented by Donald Trump. He'd refused to go on the show and face their questioning. I had 3 interviews scheduled that day, one with Howard Stern and one with Stephen Colbert. Although this one, morning TV, a largely female audience, was friendly ground, my team and I had prepared, and I felt ready. Whoopi Goldberg introduced me effusively. We are thrilled that joining us right now for her very first talk show and live TV appearance since accepting the Democratic presidential nomination. Please welcome back. She paused for a long minute, emotional. The next president of the United States. I walked on the stage to the pulsing rhythm of Beyoncé's Freedom, my campaign anthem. A standing ovation from the studio audience and warm handshakes or hugs from the panelists. Whoopi asked me about the day the president called me, so I related the story of pancakes, the grandnieces, and the upheaval that followed. Then Sunny Hostin recalled Biden's appearance on the show, during which he'd said there wasn't a single thing that he did that I could not do. What do you think would be the biggest difference between your presidency and a Biden presidency? She asked. Well, we're obviously 2 different people, and we have a lot of shared life experiences. For example, the way we feel about our family and our parents and so on. But we're also different people, and I will bring those sensibilities to how I lead. For example, one of the things I know we're going to talk about today is what we do around home health care. I've done a lot of work around violence toward women and children. I care a lot about that. I love our small businesses. I talked warmly about my second mother, Mrs. Shelton, who ran a small daycare business. So the influence of a personal experience will have its impact on a presidency, I said. If only we'd left it there. But Sunny asked a follow-up. If anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the first 4 years? I had prepped for that question. I had notes on it. There was the answer I'd given in the debate. I'm not Joe Biden, and I'm certainly not Donald Trump. I had a note that I was a new and different generation. I had prepped to say, but to specifically answer your question, throughout my career, I have worked with Democrats, independents, and Republicans, and I know that great ideas come from all places. If I'm president, I would appoint a Republican to my cabinet. But I didn't say any of that. I said, there is not a thing that comes to mind. I went on to describe things in our record that I was proud of, such as capping the price of insulin, bringing drug prices down, investing in American manufacturing, and creating 800,000 new jobs in that sector. I had no idea. I'd just pulled the pin on a hand grenade. I wasn't braced for the explosion that was coming. Stationed at various places around the set, my staff were beside themselves. Political operatives have an eye to see a moment, and I could kick myself for giving the other side that moment. During the commercial break, while I was having a bit of fun with some young students I'd noticed in the audience who were obviously playing hooky, offering to write notes to their teachers after the show, Opal passed me a note from our team telling me to return to that question and mention that a big difference would be that I would put a Republican in my cabinet. I made that point, but the damage was done. The earlier clip was a gift to the Trump campaign, and they used it in ad after ad to shackle me to an unpopular president. Why didn't I separate myself from Joe Biden? Over the course of the 107 days, I became increasingly aware that people wanted to know there was a separation and that it was a big issue for them. I just didn't realize how big. The way I heard Sonny's question was that it was asking me to be critical of Joe. I've never believed you need to elevate yourself by pushing someone else down. To do so would have been to embrace the cruelty of my opponent. In the moment, I didn't see a way to answer the question without doing that. Trial lawyers have a saying. There are always three closing arguments. The one you plan to give, the one you give, and the one you should have given. I lived the adage that afternoon. To me, the difference was evident. Different background, different generation, different career, obviously a different person. But I was still vice president to President Biden. We had 3 months left of our administration. Even after the lack of support from the White House, the debate night phone call, and the MAGA hat debacle, I felt I owed him my loyalty. Had I, in that interview, come up with one area of policy difference, it would have limited the definition of the difference between us to that one thing, rather than my unique perspective on a variety of issues. And it wouldn't have ended there. It would have opened the door to a discussion that is backward-looking rather than forward-looking. There would be a slew of never-ending follow-up questions. Well, apart from that one, how would you have made X or Y decision differently from Biden? Between the president and the vice president, there needs to be a zone of trust, a place where the president can get advice, feedback, and criticism to make a good decision and know that those discussions will remain confidential. Lawyer-client discussions are privileged. Doctor-patient conversations are too. And so, I believe, should be the discussions and arguments, and yes, differences of opinion, between the president and vice president. But my campaign team didn't see it that way. David Plouffe was the most outspoken. He felt that someone needed to do an intervention with me, that I needed to get it through my head that this was a real issue. That was when he told me bluntly, "People hate Joe Biden." He also said this, "You're going to have bad days. You're going to have to keep moving." Two of the three interviews I did that day went off well. Stephen Colbert met me backstage with his wife, and they presented me with their cookbook. He knew my days were long, and with a big smile, he said, "Let's go out and have some fun." Howard Stern was a great interlocutor. We covered very serious ground, but also had a great time, bantering about music, Maya Rudolph's impression of me, and blind dates. Yet all I could think about that night was the one interview that hadn't gone well. I'm tougher on myself than anyone, but Plouffe was right. I had to keep moving, so that is what I did. October 10th, 26 days to the election. I was in Las Vegas to record Los Latinos Preguntan, Kamala Harris Responde, a town hall with 100 undecided Latino voters to be shown that night on Univision. The questions on prices, on immigration, were not particular to the Latino community. They were the same concerns that all Americans had. But one woman became distressed as she spoke of her mother, who had died just 6 weeks earlier, unable to get U.S. citizenship in her lifetime, even after years in America and having children who had grown up as citizens. As illness overtook her, she had been unable, as a non-citizen ineligible for Medicare, to afford proper medical attention. It was an emotional moment for me. I thought of how painful it had been, watching my mother in the late stages of cancer, even with the benefit of access to good health care. I remembered trying to find soft sweaters that would not irritate her skin, trying to cook foods that she could still enjoy. I felt for this loving daughter, who had probably done all those things for her mother, and yet been unable to access the medical care that may have prolonged her life or eased her pain. One of the first bills we tried to pass within hours of Joe Biden taking the oath of office was for comprehensive immigration reform that would have provided a pathway to citizenship for hardworking, longtime residents. But it was not taken up by Congress. Democrats, rather than Republicans, got the lion's share of the blame for failing to provide a pathway to citizenship. The Latino vote began to steadily drift away from us starting in 2016. The Latino vote is no monolith, and a variety of factors were at play. For anyone struggling to afford gas or eggs, inflation was certainly a factor. Though I had a jobs and investment agenda that would have benefited Latinos, it was rolled out October 22nd. Too late to really resonate. For the grieving woman in front of me, both parties had failed her mother, failed her. In these settings, which are high stress and high stakes, it is important to stay focused and on message. But it is also important to respond as a human. I have said countless times that there is more that unites us than divides us. And sometimes you must feel it as well as say it. It requires an enormous amount of emotional dexterity. It isn't easy. And then there was the last question of the town hall. Could I name three virtues that Donald Trump possessed? I thought, really? Do I have to? I think Donald Trump loves his family, and I think that's very important, I said. I racked my brain for something else. I don't really know him, to be honest with you. I only met him one time on the debate stage. I've never met him before. So I really don't have much more to offer you, I said. It was a tougher day than usual to be trying to enumerate Trump's virtues. We'd just learned from Bob Woodward's reporting that at the height of COVID, when Americans were scrambling to get their hands on scarce COVID tests, Trump had secretly sent tests to Vladimir Putin for his personal use. I was headed from the town hall to a rally in Phoenix, where I would meet with young Native American leaders from a half dozen different tribes, including the Gila River tribe. I'd met many of the young people from that tribe a year earlier when Doug and I had visited their tribal lands. They had been the first tribe to partner with the federal government to create a community school that was fully Native-built, Native-owned, and Native-run. I'd been inspired by those young leaders, especially their knowledge of and commitment to climate solutions based on traditional knowledge and stewardship. We have so much to learn from indigenous people about how to treat this fragile earth. They were custodians of this land for thousands of years. Their long-term thinking, considering the ramifications of each decision on seven generations, makes a lot more sense than making decisions based on four-year political cycles or corporate quarterly earnings. Native Americans serve in our military at the highest rate of any population in our country. I wondered how many Native veterans could have used the test kits Trump sent to Putin as their communities were ravaged by the virus. October 13th, 23 days to the election. It was Doug's birthday. He and I were born 7 days apart. We joke that he dropped down to Earth to check out the situation a week before I arrived. We are both Libras, and friends who believe in astrology say it is totally unsurprising that we spend half an hour to an hour weighing the pros and cons of which TV show we will watch, and by the time we've settled it, it's time to go to bed. Doug started his birthday campaigning in Pennsylvania. His team had cupcakes and balloons, but the real birthday gift was having our daughter, Ella, at his side that day, campaigning with him. I was in church at Koinonia Christian Center in Greenville, North Carolina, telling the congregation how inspired I'd been by a man from Hope Springs, Eddie, who had jumped into floodwaters to pull a woman to safety during Hurricane Helene. He had told me he didn't feel he had a choice. I told the congregation, of course he had a choice. His choice was, in the words of Isaiah, to be a refuge for the needy in their distress. After church, I spoke at a rally and then had a meeting with black farmers. When pundits talk about rural America, the picture they paint is white. But in the South especially, some rural counties are majority black, including long-standing farming families who have persevered on the land for generations, despite discrimination that began just after Reconstruction and continued right into this century. Black farmers never got their 40 acres and a mule, the promised reparation for their years of enslavement, and the wealth their stolen labor had created for this country. Worse, they were systematically discriminated against by governments both local and federal. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has only in recent years examined its shameful history of denying credit and subsidies to black farmers while providing them to whites. This was especially damaging in the crucial years of early 20th century agricultural industrialization, when white farmers received subsidies and credit to buy the new machinery that would increase efficiency and raise yields. The Inflation Reduction Act, for which I was the tie-breaking vote, provided funds to begin to compensate any farmer who had been discriminated against by the USDA. The farmers I spoke with that day were resilient elderly couples and also young farmers, full of ideas on how to get their fresh produce where it was needed into urban food deserts. On the front lines of the climate crisis, farmers see more clearly than anyone the changes in the frost-free date, growing seasons, pests. They were using high-tech methods to make water and fertilizer use more efficient. We talked about the potential of city farms and of giving urban youth a chance to experience work on the land and learn agricultural skills while incorporating the tech these young people already understood with the traditions of farming. Our neighbor, Mrs. Shelton, had a sister who had a farm. Maya and I would go to Annie B's to help pick up fallen plums in her orchard. I was lucky, as a city kid, to have that experience, to learn the labor that brings us our food. These were programs I was intent to support as president. I knew that Doug would arrive back to the residence before I could get there, so I had the staff drape the entrance with a banner saying, "Happy birthday, Dougie." I have to confess that since I didn't get home until just after 7 p.m., I got a little help with the prep for his celebratory dinner. It was his favorite menu, chicken parm with spaghetti, followed by key lime pie. I had bought his gift via FaceTime with his favorite menswear store in San Francisco. It was a sports coat, black and gray. He looked great in it. October 14th, 22 days to the election. The Los Angeles Times, my hometown newspaper, published its electoral endorsements. The first line of the article stated, quote, "It's no exaggeration to say this may be the most consequential election in a generation." But there was no mention of the most consequential race of all. The paper's owner, Patrick Soon-Chung, had directed the editorial's editor, Marielle Garza, to deep-six the endorsement of me that the editorial board had approved and she had already drafted. She quit. In her resignation letter, Garza said it mattered that the largest newspaper in California, quote, "declined to endorse in a race this important, and it matters that we won't even be straight with people about it. It makes us look craven and hypocritical, maybe even a bit sexist and racist," she wrote. "How could we spend 8 years railing against Trump and the danger his leadership poses to the country and then fail to endorse the perfectly decent Democratic challenger who we previously endorsed for the United States Senate?" she asked. It hurt that my hometown paper hadn't endorsed me. And then 11 days later, my other hometown paper, the Washington Post, did the same thing. The endorsement of me that had been prepared by the editorial board was scrapped at the direction of Jeff Bezos. The pre-capitulation of these powerful billionaires alarmed and dispirited me. As it turned out, they were early adopters of the feckless posture that would be embraced by a raft of business leaders and institutions once Trump was elected. They'd just been the first in line to grovel. Marty Baron, the acclaimed former editor who led the Post during the first Trump presidency, was blunt. Quote, "This is cowardice, a moment of darkness that will leave democracy as a casualty. Donald Trump will celebrate this as an invitation to further intimidate the Post's owner, Jeff Bezos, and other media owners. History will mark a disturbing chapter of spinelessness at an institution famed for courage." More than 200,000 Post readers canceled their subscriptions. At least the Post political humor columnist, Alexandra Petri, now at The Atlantic, had a spine. She wrote, "We as a newspaper suddenly remembered less than 2 weeks before the election that we had a robust tradition 50 years ago of not telling anyone what to do with their vote for president. It is time we got back to those, quote, roots, I'm told." Roots are important, of course. As recently as the 1970s, the Post did not endorse a candidate for president. As recently as centuries ago, there was no Post, and the country had a king. She went on to write, "But if I were the paper, I would be a little embarrassed that it has fallen to me, the humor columnist, to make our presidential endorsement. I will spare you the suspense. I am endorsing Kamala Harris for president because I like elections and want to keep having them." October 15th, 21 days to the election. I was in the back of the plane doing one of my usual off-the-record question sessions with the traveling press. One of the reporters, whom I'd come to know quite well, furrowed his brow and asked, "What do you think's going on?" We locked eyes for a long moment. Then I answered with the simple truth, "I don't know." After drawing even with Trump in the polls in August and pulling ahead of him after the debate in September, by mid-October, we'd stalled out. The rallies were getting bigger, the crowds ever more diverse and enthusiastic, but the poll numbers were static. 3 weeks out, we were stuck in margin of error territory and not budging. And then, like most guys who watch a lot of sports, Doug started seeing the trans ads. No matter what he was watching, football, baseball, there they were. The Trump campaign would eventually spend as much as $40 million on those ads. They showed some version of it 55,000 times in the 7 swing states. They showed it in all 50 states during sport broadcasts. Gabrielle Ludwig, the basketball player featured prominently in the ad, was at home in Nevada watching an Eagles game when she was astonished to see herself in a photograph that had been taken 12 years earlier. She was 52 at the time of that photo. A registered Republican, she'd served 8 years in the Navy and had gone to community college later in life, as many veterans do. She's a big woman, but she also looks strikingly different from her teammates because she's 3 decades older than they are, which hardly gave her the athletic advantage the ad implied. Trump's team wasn't concerned with nuance. With the tagline, quote, "Kamala is for they, them, President Trump is for you," they thought they had landed on a winning message. Unfortunately, they were right, although not to the extent that has become conventional wisdom. Why didn't I punch back harder? There are 2 things to talk about. One is people, one is politics. Let's start with people. Transgender people are Americans with the same rights we all have to liberty, equality, the pursuit of happiness, and equal protection under the law. There aren't very many, a tiny minority of less than 1% of the population. Of these, in 2024, less than 10 played on women's college sports teams. Less than 10. The law says incarcerated people must be provided with medical care. Under that law, 2 federal prisoners have received court-ordered gender affirmation surgery. 2. Very small numbers. But here are some bigger ones. 350 transgender people were murdered in America in 2024. 15 of them were kids. Trans people are over 4 times as likely as other Americans to be victims of a violent crime. Almost half, 42%, have attempted suicide. I have been an ally of the LGBTQ+ community for my entire career. As Attorney General, I fought for their safety by outlawing the so-called gay panic defense in California. As DA and then as Attorney General, I defended their right to marry the person they love. I have joyful memories of performing some of the first gay marriage ceremonies in 2004, long before it was the law of the land and long before it was supported by most elected Democrats. In the 2004 presidential election, gay marriage was used as a wedge issue by Republicans, just as the trans issue was in 2024. And I'm sorry to say that in 2004, our candidate did not stand up. In the Bay Area, I grew up at the epicenter of the fight for LGBTQ+ civil rights. One of my first political advisors, Jim Rivaldo, had worked for the assassinated gay leader, Harvey Milk. When Jim was dying from AIDS, my mother helped take care of him. This is a community with which I have a deep connection. I know transgender people. I know the parents of transgender kids. Beloved kids, just like any other. I know the pain and struggle that many families go through. I've heard so many personal stories. And I know the risks many of these children face from bullying and violence. Imagine being a parent, loving your child, and worrying every day about the ugliness and attacks they might encounter. And for some families, there are acute worries about depression, substance abuse, suicide. It's the height of hypocrisy for the party that has always championed the right of parents to make decisions for their children regarding homeschooling or opting out of sex ed, to suddenly bring down the awesome power of the state on loving parents trying to figure out care for their children. When Republicans lied about this tiny, vulnerable group with fear campaigns about school kids being taken away for gender surgery without parents' knowledge, I knew that Trump's increasingly hateful rhetoric was painting a bullseye on their backs and putting them in peril. I've always been a protector. It's why I became a prosecutor. There was no way I was going to go against my very nature and turn on transgender people right when they were being so intensely and intentionally vilified. I was aware of the weight of my voice and had no intention of adding to their burden. And then there is the politics. When I was Attorney General in 2015, a state prisoner sued to get gender-affirming surgery. My client was the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and as its lawyer, I was required to support the case against that inmate, which we settled in the inmate's favor. In 2017, a transgender prisoner in California was the first to get gender-affirming surgery based on that case, and 22 others have followed in California. That's the law. But because I'd been on the opposing side of the case, a cry went up. Kamala doesn't care about trans people. That wasn't true. I wanted to rebut that claim. When the ACLU in 2019 asked me to fill out a questionnaire, and one of the questions was about gender health care for incarcerated adults, I said I supported whatever was medically necessary, which is what the law says and what Donald Trump upheld as president. During his term, trans people in federal prison received the hormone treatments they were seeking. I reiterated that view when asked in an interview. And that was what the Trump team sliced and diced for their ad. The ad also said that I supported, quote, biological men competing against our girls in their sports, unquote. That is not my position. I agree with the concerns expressed by parents and players that we have to take into account biological factors such as muscle mass and unfair athletic advantage when we determine who plays on which teams, especially in contact sports. With goodwill and common sense, I believe we can come up with ways to do this without vilifying and demonizing children. The pundits proclaim as conventional wisdom that the ad was Trump's knockout punch, that this was the principal factor that stalled us out in mid-October. I believe that it is the conventional wisdom of middle-aged men who don't live in battleground states and were the target of those ads. Men like Doug, who watch a lot of sports, the first time he saw the ad, he wanted to yell at the TV screen. He told me, "It made me viscerally ill." He was hearing clamor for a rebuttal from Joe Scarborough, Bill Clinton, and Democrats who saw that ad during the World Series and didn't see any ads rebutting it from our side. Because we didn't run ads during baseball games in non-battleground states. We did our best to rebut it in battleground states. The approach that worked best in our testing was to say, Trump says a lot of things about me, but I know the thing you care about is the economy, and quickly pivot to our messages on price gouging, affordable housing, and small business tax relief. And that was the ad we ran in rebuttal in the swing states. I do not regret my decision to follow my protective instincts. I do regret not giving even more attention to how we might mitigate Trump's attacks. Character matters, and voters respect it. When I was DA, I did not seek the death penalty in a case I successfully prosecuted for the murder of a police officer. There were demonstrations, death threats. The AG, a Democrat, and the U.S. attorney tried to take the case away from me. I thought my career was over. Years later, an elderly man from a conservative part of town approached me. "You know, I didn't agree with your decision, but I respect the fact that you said who you were and what you were going to do, and you stuck with it." I wish I could have gotten the message across that there isn't a distinction between they, them, and you. The pronoun that matters is we. We the people, and that's who I am for. October 16th, 20 days to the election. Of course, Bret Baier wanted to talk about the trans ad. He wanted to talk, period. Especially while I was talking. He interrupted me 38 times in the 27-minute interview. I certainly wasn't expecting kid glove treatment from Fox News. More like boxing gloves. I knew exactly what I was getting into. Being interviewed by Fox's chief political correspondent. After the Fox News decision desk correctly called Arizona for Biden in the 2020 election and faced a backlash from its MAGA audience, Baier had written an email that said, quote, "I keep having to defend this on air. The sooner we pull it, even if it gives us major egg, and we put it back in his column, the better we are," unquote. I knew that Bret Baier was scared of the MAGA base and would go hard on me to placate them. But I wasn't about to write off his audience. I was running to be president for all Americans, including Fox viewers. I was making a point just by being there. Trump had pulled out of a 60 Minutes interview and a CNN town hall. He turned down CNBC. And I'm pretty sure Rachel Maddow didn't even bother to ask. It was clear he would only venture onto the friendliest of turf. My view was quite the opposite. If any Fox viewers were persuadable, then I was going to make the effort to get in front of them. Baier might as well have been interviewing himself. He wouldn't let me finish a sentence before interjecting. We spent 10 minutes of the 27 talking over each other on immigration before moving to the transgender subject and then on to Joe Biden's age. It was the MAGA playlist. But he made one major blunder. When I criticized Trump for his threats to use the military on United States citizens and lock up his political opponents, calling the American people, quote, the enemy within, Bear then tried to refute it with a clip from a town hall Fox had conducted with Trump earlier that day. The clip showed Trump saying, quote, I'm not threatening anybody. I'd watched that town hall on the plane on the way to the interview. I immediately recognized that Bear had cherry-picked the most innocuous part of the quote, because Trump had also said that the biggest threat to America isn't China or Russia. Quote, it is the enemy from within, and they're very dangerous. They're Marxist and communist and fascist, and they're sick. The Pelosis, these people, they're so sick, and they're so evil, unquote. I challenged Bear on his deception and quoted the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, who said Donald Trump is, quote, the most dangerous person to this country. I was pretty sure it would be the first time many in the Fox audience would have heard that. I had been advised, and I believed, that of all the Fox anchors, Bear was the most professional and the most reasonable, that he would be tough but fair. During the interview, I had called him a serious journalist, but I felt that the stunt with the video clip was the work of a propagandist. I have a saying, disappointment is a function of unreasonable expectations. At that point, I was deeply disappointed and realized my expectations had been quite unrealistic. There had been no small talk when I arrived for that interview, and there was none when I left. I took off my mic, said thank you to his crew, and walked away. October 17th, 19 days to the election. Democracy is complicated, and some days are more complicated than others. That day, Mark Cuban was traveling with me to speak about entrepreneurship at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. As we approached the campus, Gaza protesters held signs saying, Killer Kamala. Later, at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, it was no ceasefire, no vote. And then, in the middle of an upbeat rally in the university gym, there were two anti-abortion protesters. I was in the middle of my speech laying out Trump's direct responsibility for the repeal of Roe when I heard cries of, Liar, you're lying. I smiled in the direction of the hecklers. Oh, you guys are at the wrong rally, I said. I think you meant to go to the smaller one down the street. The audience roared with laughter. Later, the two juniors would go on Fox and Friends and claim that I had told them they were at the wrong rally after I heard them shout, Jesus is Lord, Christ is King. That's just not true. The C-SPAN video of the moment clearly picks up the cries of liar right before I made the quip. However, another video made by a Fox reporter somewhere in the middle of the auditorium does have the young men proclaiming their faith, although there's no way of telling at what point in my speech. Whenever it was, I never heard it, and I was certainly not responding to that. I would never make fun of anyone or say they weren't welcome at my rally for praising God. On Fox and Friends, the host accepted the students' claims and showed an edited video, but not the C-SPAN footage where it's clear I'm responding to cries of liar. One of the young men compared himself to Jesus, who also, quote, was mocked. He said he believed they were sent by God. Then as the panel was wrapping up the segment, one student interjected, If I could say something before we go here, the host told him to go ahead. If I could ask my young Americans in this country, what do you want your future to look like in this country? Do you want to have to struggle to pay for gas? Do you want to struggle to afford groceries on a daily basis? Do you want to even struggle to get your first mortgage on a house? Because that is the future you're going to get with Kamala Harris as president, a future where people are stripped of the very power they have as citizens of the United States, unquote. It seemed like the student was suddenly less interested in preaching the gospel of Jesus than the gospel of Trump. In the first weeks of my campaign, the interjectors at my rallies had mainly been Gaza protesters, people deeply moved by the war. But as the election drew closer, Trump supporters began turning up to disrupt. Which is fine, they can say whatever they believe to be true, it's a democracy. But it becomes a danger to democracy when powerful news organizations, who should be in the business of supplying facts, instead distort them for partisan reasons. Because of that Fox and Friends segment, it is now an internet, quote, fact that I ejected two young people from my rally for praising God. The false rally narrative fed neatly into another line of attack Fox had been running that week, that I had dissed the Catholic Church by not attending the Al Smith dinner. This annual white tie event in New York in support of Catholic charities has traditionally been a good-humored affair where opposing politicians gently roast each other. Trump broke with that tradition when he delivered an unfunny and mean-spirited diatribe about Hillary Clinton, his fellow guest, in 2016. He was booed, a first in the history of the dinner. His rude behavior didn't determine my decision not to attend in person. With just over 2 weeks to the election, I simply didn't want to be in a solidly Democratic state when I could be campaigning in a swing state. So my team had discussed with the dinner organizers that I would make a video instead, and they were agreeable. I did a comic bit with Molly Shannon, playing Mary Catherine Gallagher, her dorky Catholic schoolgirl character from Saturday Night Live. I followed that up with remarks about my sincere respect for Catholic charities. I had worked closely with them in California on issues such as providing relief to unaccompanied immigrant children, victims of domestic violence, and in my Back on Track initiative for formerly incarcerated young adults. Fox and Friends didn't mention that. They made it sound as if I'd shunned the event entirely because of the same anti-Catholic, anti-Christian animus that they had falsely alleged. Democracy is complicated. It's also easily compromised by blatant bias, downright lies, and the media organizations that enable them. October 19th, 17 days to the election. And our democracy shouldn't belong to the world's richest man. I was holding a rally in Atlanta with Usher when I heard about Elon Musk's first $1 million giveaway. According to campaign disclosures, Musk spent at least $288 million in support of Trump, maybe even more through indirect sources. It is entirely possible that those millions were the deciding factor in the swing states where the money was mostly spent and where Trump's margin of victory was wafer thin. Elon certainly thinks so. Quote, "Without me, Trump would have lost the election," unquote, he tweeted in the midst of a snit with Trump over his massive spending bill. He clearly thought he had bought the presidency and should be able to dictate Trump's agenda, perhaps the most brazen admission of corruption in history. In the blue wall states that could have made me president, Trump beat me by just 0.86% in Wisconsin, 1.44% in Michigan, and 1.73% in Pennsylvania. Ours was the third closest presidential election in a century. Musk hired paid door knockers, about 400 in each swing state, far outpacing the Trump campaign's own listless efforts at mounting any kind of ground game. On my first day as top of the ticket, 28,000 volunteers signed up. By the end of the week, it was 170,000. For the battleground states, from that first day, we knocked on 19.5 million doors, and 13.4 million of these were done by volunteers. Musk's notorious $1 million, quote, random sweepstakes, which his lawyers have since admitted in court was anything but random, drove traffic to X, where he could praise Trump and denigrate me with insults and fake images, such as the ridiculous AI-generated picture where I am depicted wearing a cap with a hammer and sickle. He was Trump's one-man super PAC and campaign media arm all rolled into one. The 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision gave corporations in the top 1% the ability to funnel unlimited money into our elections. In the Senate, I and my colleagues introduced a constitutional amendment designed to overturn it. It has been reintroduced unsuccessfully in each Congress. There were other efforts beyond the constitutional amendment, such as laws to disclose donor information, but none of those passed either. I have always been one of my party's most successful fundraisers, and I don't apologize for that. To do good work, you must get elected. And unfortunately, until Congress has the courage to change the laws, it's ridiculously expensive. After Joe dropped out, I raised more money more quickly than any candidate ever. But it wasn't from a single billionaire with huge government contracts who essentially bought himself an unelected co-presidency. Musk lied about his sweepstakes, saying names would be drawn at random, and any registered voter in a swing state who signed a petition supporting the First and Second Amendments could be in the drawing. But when courts questioned the legality of that, his lawyers admitted that the winners were not random. They were vetted, quote, spokespeople. As for his paid door knockers, many were individuals who had to sign contracts before they knew whom they would be canvassing for. They included low-income Black people who were transported to their canvassing turf in the backs of U-Hauls with no seat belts or even seats, forced to share rooms with strangers and given impossible work quotas. Some who objected were fired without pay and without fares to return to their home states. While Musk takes a chainsaw to programs that help the poorest people in our own country and abroad, he is okay with government spending when it comes to his own companies, which have received about $38 billion in contracts, loans, subsidies, and tax credits, roughly $15 billion from NASA, and about $7 billion from defense agencies. For some, like the spy satellite Starshield defense project, the amounts are not publicly documented. As the former head of the National Space Council, I am enthusiastic about space exploration. I support technological innovation and national security. But when you never talk about government spending on your own interests, no matter how laudable those interests, it's hypocritical to critique spending on equally valuable programs such as research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health. His companies also stand to benefit from slashed regulations on environmental protection and the lack of consumer protections for autonomous vehicles. No good public policy can be made with a chainsaw. October 20th, 16 days to the election. When I was growing up, birthdays were a very big deal. My mother used to joke that my birthday was her birthday as well, since she's the one who'd done the birthing. I think about my mother every day. But that morning, she was especially on my mind, since my birthday fell on Pink Sunday, the day in Breast Cancer Awareness Month when churches pray for those who are suffering or who have passed from the disease. My mother had two goals in her life, to raise Maya and me, and to cure breast cancer. When we were little, we knew that often Mommy had to go to Bethesda. We didn't know that she went to that Maryland neighborhood as an advisor to the National Institutes of Health. As I pinned the pink awareness pin to my lapel, I thought of her and her uncompromising dedication to the cause of women's health. I made a silent promise never to let up and never let her down in my commitment to that issue. My senior advisor, Jaleesa Washington Price, had worked with me since 2019, and even though she has three small children, she put her life on hold for these 107 days, organizing in three key states and handling faith outreach. That Sunday, she had selected two extraordinary faith communities for me to visit. I was heading to New Birth Missionary Baptist Church that Sunday morning, a mega church in Atlanta's suburbs. Chrisette, who had flown in to be with me on my birthday, was there, wide-eyed. Chrisette comes from a different faith tradition, what she describes as, quote, a quiet little Presbyterian church. This was not that. The sanctuary seats over 7,000 souls. We arrived as the choir was singing and made my way to my seat past throngs of women in pink, some in frothy tulle or sparkly pink sequined church hats. There were more than 50 elected officials at that service, as well as my friend Opal Lee, the grandmother of Juneteenth, and Reverend Amos Brown, who had flown in as a surprise. When the pastor, Jamal Bryant, called on me to speak, someone in the congregation called out, "Happy birthday," which was the